no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.
Our press secretary gave alternative facts to that.
My goal in this deposition was to be truthful, but not particularly helpful.
Welcome to Unspun, the podcast that makes you better at finding the truth. The way people get news is changing. It used to be that there were many reporters who would research stories and write articles, but now politicians and famous people share information directly with you on social media and the internet. That means you find out things fast, but it's up to you to make sure the information's actually accurate. And newsmakers don't always do their part. The temptation to manipulate information is strong. They bend the truth to deceive so that they can avoid accountability, so that they can advance their agendas. When you recognize these agendas, you can sometimes find out what's real. And we're at a crossroads where anyone can share anything online, so it's important to sharpen your critical thinking skills. Finding that deception before it goes viral is pretty much a survival skill now, and we're going to do it together. Let's get unspun. Hello, truth seekers, and welcome to this week's Unspun. Today, we're going to hear about the logical problem that can actually make giant, untrue assumptions about large groups of people. And then, my guest, ProPublica's Craig Silverman, and I talk about verification, or what the news media does to try to make sure they get all the facts straight. Sound good? Let's get unspun. Before we get started, though, a quick shout-out to Betsy and Erica, who both took time to write to me at theunspunpodcast@gmail.com. I really love hearing from y'all and knowing what's on your mind and how I can make the show better. I even write back. Okay. Onto the topic of the day. Today, let's talk about the division fallacy. It's when we assume that something true for a group has to be true for every single person in it. Maybe like saying everyone on a winning team is a superstar athlete. You know, the team may be great, but there may be somebody who's just really good at strategy, or they're a killer motivator, but they're just not a point scorer. Or perhaps you could think about a delicious pie. Pie. You'd think a pie is delicious, especially my favorite, a pumpkin pie, so everything that goes into the pie must also be delicious. And maybe I thought that as a little kid, and, you know, I loved it so much that I snuck up behind my great-grandmother as she was making one, and I stuck my finger into one of the ingredients and popped it into my mouth. Sadly, it was the salt. Pie is great, but you can't assume that everything you make it out of is also delicious. It's that combination that makes it work. So how does this whole division fallacy thing play out in real world? Well, let's jump right into an example from the world of politics. Have a listen for this week's warm-up.
Now, of course, Donald Trump has been very clear that on the abortion policy specifically, that we have a big country and it's diverse. And California has a different viewpoint on this than Georgia. Georgia has a different viewpoint from Arizona. And the proper way to handle this, as messy as democracy sometimes is to let voters make these decisions, let the individual states make their abortion policy. And I think that's what makes the most sense in a very big, a very diverse, and let's be honest, sometimes a very, very messy and divided country.
That was Vice Presidential candidate J.D. Vance, who was both arguing against the division fallacy and making it at the same time. So what's the problem? He's arguing, on the one hand, that you can't assume that every state in the United States has the same opinions as the others, or that because the country goes a particular way, every state would want that. And fair enough, right? But listen to this. He's also arguing that everyone within a state feels the same way, almost as if Arizona or California have feelings. And that's a divisions fallacy, because we know that states are made up of citizens, right? And it's the people that matter. It's a really common one in politics where a majority can win. We see politicians all the time who win extremely close elections by small percentages of the votes. And then they act like they have a mandate that all of the people that they represent agree with them. They'll call them the American people, or the voters of the 12th district, or whatever. as if those representatives are not accountable for representing even the people who disagree with them. So we need to be real, and to an extent, you do have to make assumptions that are going to assign views to people who don't have them in order to get anything done in government. And I will say different countries do this differently. So, for example, it's my understanding that in Scandinavia, they work to build an agreement between as many people as possible as a kind of an ethic that they have. On the other hand, maybe it's a little more practical in a parliamentary system with multiple parties like the UK and France. You may be building coalitions as a way of many people at least getting some of what they want. But in the US, you can be winner-take-all. Honestly, I'm not sure that's smart, because you end up focusing on winning, because you have to win everything to get anything. But that is where we are. On the issue of abortion, though, in particular, it seems unlikely to the point of probably being wrong to assume that something as big as a state would have all of the citizens with a unified opinion. This whole idea of the division fallacy really hits home with a topic that's been in the headlines, vaccines. It's a big one where we see the fallacy pop up. So, for example, even before COVID, vaccine hesitancy caused some measles outbreaks. And it was really definitely a tense time with a lot of uncertainty and fear. But during that time, former California State Senator Richard Pan, who's also a pediatrician, made a statement during a debate about vaccine exemptions, which is where a parent could get it so that their child could go to school but not have to have the vaccine. He said, quote, "Clearly, we're going to have to contend with a large number of people who, unfortunately, are misinformed about vaccines." Misinformed. That's a loaded word, and it just kind of highlights the danger of falling into the division fallacy trap, doesn't it? I mean, assuming that just because someone is hesitant about vaccines, they're automatically misinformed. So Dr. Pan is stating that anti-vaccine parents, and other people who maybe aren't parents but still oppose vaccines, do so because they lack information about them. And, you know, I will say that some anti-vaccine views are driven by incorrect information about risky side effects. You know, so for example, a belief in a debunked theory about a link to autism. This is not the only reason, though, that people oppose vaccines. For example, religious belief and worry about government overreach also play a role. And it's not entirely certain that just providing more information about how safe vaccines are is going to change the minds of everyone who opposes them. Assuming that someone belongs to the group of people who object to vaccines are misinformed is an example of the fallacy of division. And so, you know, if we want to have any hope of having a productive conversation or finding common ground, maybe even changing minds, we have to start by acknowledging that. So how do we do that? How do we break free from that trap? Well, for starters, I think it requires a conscious effort to be curious rather than judgmental. Curious about the why behind people's choices instead of just assuming we know better. You know, we can ask questions, we can listen with an open mind, and we can try to understand where they're coming from. So instead of just assuming we know what others think or believe, we should be asking more questions. We should be listening, and we should try to understand their perspective, even if we know we're not going to agree with it. That, I think, is the key to bridging those divides and maybe even finding some common ground. Okay, I need to take a quick break, but when I come back, Craig Silverman and I are going to talk about misinformation. Craig is a writer for ProPublica, but also the editor of the European Journalism Center's Verification Handbook series. These are free online books that I actually use in my journalism classes for their excellent guidance on how to verify content and investigate disinformation and media manipulation. You're not going to want to miss this. I'll be back in a moment. Welcome back. And Craig, welcome to Unspun.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm so excited to have you on the show this week. You're one of the OGs when it comes to investigating and kind of teaching about fake news. And it seems to me like even the term has changed over the past 10 years. So I'd really love to get your perspective on sort of the threats that we have to quality information right now. So maybe we could start with journalism and journalists themselves. Do you think journalists are doing a good enough job of getting information?
Oh, this is an eternal question, right? Have we ever had a point where we were doing a great job of it? There's always going to be always a lot even of room for improvement. And I think if we look at differences between, you know, a few decades ago and now, I think the verification challenge is much more significant. And so, you know, you could look at it and you know, there's more media out there than ever before. So you're going to have varying degrees of quality, varying degrees of, you know, processes of verification. And so that's maybe, it sounds like I'm dodging the question, but I mean, I think the biggest thing that concerns me right now in this area is that we have this new challenge, which is a massive abundance of information coming from all different kinds of sources, coming in lots of different formats, text, video, audio, and a massive new world of tools for manipulating all different kinds of information. So the challenge of verification is, in that sense, way more complicated and difficult because, you know, in the old days, it's like you get some information, maybe it usually came from a human or some documents, and then you take some time and you'd call around and you try to figure things out. And today, there's a speed factor. Something may already be out there and in people engaging with it, and you're trying to figure it out. Obviously, the emergence of AI tools for fabricating digital, you know, audio, video, what have you. So, I mean, I think the thing, all of that brings me to the concern, which is that I don't think the education of your average journalist, the training of your average journalist, and the ongoing management and training of journalists already in newsrooms is anywhere close to providing the basic level of sort of digital verification fundamentals that we need to have. And so that's the piece that really concerns me, is not everybody needs to be like a crazy OSINT specialist who could work on the New York Times visual investigations team, but everybody needs to understand what reverse image search is. And when I do trainings to rooms full of professional journalists, I don't get 100% of hands up when I ask how many of you are familiar with reverse image search. So that's sort of where my concern is about the job we're doing on this. And then the last piece I'll add is just, there is a very organized, concerted effort to feed false and misleading information to journalists and to discredit journalists now. So we need to be more on our toes in some ways than ever before.
So you used a term I'm not sure everyone in my audience is familiar with. Can you define OSINT for me?
It's funny because this is a term I hadn't heard of until I don't know how many years ago. And it's one that I never used. I always just like to talk about digital investigations and digital verification, but OSINT stands for open source intelligence. And this is a term that, as you could sort of hear from it, if you're not familiar with it, does come from kind of the world of like military and intelligence. You know, they talk about signals intelligence. So SIGINT, meaning the stuff that the NSA grabs from, you know, signals from around the world. And they talk about HUMINT, which is human intelligence from actual human sources. And then OSINT emerged in this sort of new, primarily digital realm where there is so much information available openly on the internet, on social media platforms, on databases that have been left open. All of this open source information, meaning you don't need fancy surveillance or intelligence equipment for it. It's not stuff locked away behind passwords or what have you. It is open. It is available typically in the digital environment for you to gather. And so, you know, that includes everything from, as I say, like social media networks to, you know, open and available satellite data to data. You know, what do you see on websites? What information can you get from domain registrations and those kinds of things? So that's what I mean by OSINT. And it's been more and more integrated, I think, into a lot of elements of journalism. But the term itself, I always still feel like resides in that other world of like law enforcement and intelligence and military. And it's funny, actually, you know, some people have said to me, journalists should really never use that term because, you know, we're trying to obviously report on the military and intelligence. We shouldn't necessarily be adapting their terms. But it's kind of a ubiquitous term now in that whole world that I feel like I can't avoid it now.
Fair enough. So you mentioned a number of challenges, right? For example, the timing challenge, the volume of information challenge, things like that. Are any of these challenges also opportunities for journalists?
Yes. I mean, the short, emphatic answer on that is absolutely yes. You know, just the overall process of, you know, the evolution of digital platforms and information and the internet has created more opportunities for more voices and more people to participate and share and, you know, and practice acts of journalism, as it's sometimes sort of referred to. And so those are, you know, wonderful new potential opportunities and things that have presented themselves. And for the world that I live in of sort of verification and investigative work, I mean, this is what has brought so many opportunities for digging into people and companies and also to kind of the digital environment itself. And so there's a tremendous opportunity on the most basic level where if you're a journalist and you're reporting on a person or a company, you absolutely need to be looking at their digital footprint as part of your efforts of backgrounding and researching them. And And, you know, the idea that so many people around the world have smartphones with cameras and are, you know, in a place where they're not a journalist, but suddenly they are actually the person on the ground who could potentially live stream or record something. That for news gathering and for actually being able to see something either as it happens or shortly after it has happened is a revolutionary thing, because we can actually be closer to the story anywhere in the world thanks to those kinds of technologies and that ability. And, you know, that is a very big and transformative thing.
It seems like it's kind of a two-edged sword though, right? Because if you're looking at that sort of, you know, user-generated content kind of thing, we might say then that the extra step of verification, that has to happen, right? So it's almost a circle.
Right. So that's it. I mean, so it's like, it's sort of like you always have to swing both edges of the sword, I guess. Is that maybe mixing it, you know, maybe a poor kind of metaphor there. But the reality is, like, to take advantage of so much of the information and the openness and the more voices and the data and all that's available, you can't just sort of drink it all in and take it like as it is. You have to gather, and then you have to practice the discipline of verification, which is, you know, as was written in that great little book, The Elements of Journalism. I mean, that is at its core what journalism is. We are not just repeaters of what we find, and we are not just gatherers. We have to gather and verify, and then from that point to actually decide, you know, what to put out. And so you have to really take the full advantage of this new environment. You have to understand fundamentally your duty around verification, but then also how do you actually practice it, which brings a lot of traditional thinking and approaches to verification, but some new thinking and tools that can be applied as well.
Do you think some of the challenges are different if you're thinking of maybe like local outlets versus national outlets or print versus broadcast?
I mean, I think some of the challenges are different. You know, for example, if we think about sort of local versus national, I mean, anytime something is happening in a specific geographic location, if you're talking about newsrooms that are people who live in that community and cover it regularly, I mean, I do think that there are inherent advantages. They understand the geography. They may know people close to or involved in the actual event. They may know the reputation of people who are putting information out there and the particular agendas they may have. And so so that contextual knowledge is really, really helpful and important. And it's something that, you know, journalists from the national level sort of stomp all over sometimes when they, you know, parachute in. And that's not a new story, right? That's been, you know, something that you'll hear local folks complain about a lot. But then the flip side of that is if we take, for example, some of the QAnon movement stuff, so the QAnon conspiracy theory, you know, they're one of the tenets of that is that, you know, typically they say, you know, people in the Democratic Party are engaged in massive acts of like sexual abuse of children. And so at certain points over time, there have been protests locally of people like marching and holding up signs of like, save the children, protect the children, what have you. And local media would sometimes cover them and just describe them as concerned local parents about the welfare of children, not realizing that this is actually part of a larger sort of conspiracy movement. And that if you actually dug and scratched below the surface, they're not just concerned parents. What they're concerned about is that they think there is a massive global conspiracy that is abusing and hiding and trafficking children, and it's connected at the highest levels of the Democratic Party. And if you knew that, then obviously your choice whether to cover that protest or not, or how to cover it, becomes very different.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense. So we've known for a while now that most people, when they're getting news, they're getting it first from social media. And some of the stuff that you see on social media comes from sort of known news sources, and some just doesn't, right? How has the shift to getting news on social media changed the quality of information that people have access to?
What it's done, I think, is it has vastly expanded perhaps the scale of quality in a certain way. So we've always had rumors and gossip. It's a very natural human thing to engage in. And so, but typically, you know, our rumoring and our gossiping were in areas like at our workplace and about our community at home or that kind of thing. They were, you know, there was some gating around that to a certain extent. But now, where you might be in a group with friends or family members or a group with a certain subject matter focus online, suddenly, you know, you can have stuff coming in from a wide range of topics. So it's expanded that. And then in terms of like expanding the scale of quality, you know, again, you can still have like high quality verified information. You can have direct eyewitness information coming from people that's happened to be in your group, which is, you know, helpful and useful. And then you can have things that have been, you know, 100% fabricated and made up that have been, you know, or the most common type of thing we see is maybe it's a real photo or a real video, but the context has been, you know, made misleading. So it's like, yeah, this is what's happening, you know, down the street, and here's a photo of it. Maybe it's a photo of like a bloody person, but that photo could be 4 years old from a completely different event in another part of the world. And so we're suddenly facing this challenge of getting information that can often feel urgent and getting it in a stream that also kind of triggers a little bit of sense of urgency. But it is ranging from, you know, unintentionally misleading to 100% fabricated to just sort of like partially true to stuff that's been manufactured by state-backed disinformation campaigns to things that might be, you know, your sort of average political spin. And so the range of the types of information and the level of quality, I think, has expanded greatly, which again, like, it presents a challenge to all of us as we're trying to navigate a very chaotic information environment. And I think the first step for everybody is just to understand that, understand how the dynamics have changed and how you're going to encounter information that is from a wide variety, potentially, of different sources, has been treated or mistreated in a variety of ways. And you've got to be willing to sit there and sort of pause for a second and think about it before you dive in.
Yeah, well, so one solution that people kind of push sometimes is pressuring the platforms, right, to devalue or even kind of remove false information. Has this been effective, or I know there's been some political pushback on censorship.
Well, I think there's a couple areas where you could say they've been pretty successful, and it varies from platform to platform. But there's certain kind of low-hanging fruit that if we go back in time to around 2016, you know, now Meta, then Facebook, was really doing very, very little in this area of kind of information quality and manipulation and deception. You know, they didn't want porn. They didn't want pirated stuff. They didn't want spammy kinds of things. But in terms of sort of false claims, they didn't really see that as their job. But as we get to the end of 2016, Facebook decides, well, we're going to enter in a relationship with, you know, what they call third-party fact checkers from, you know, from around the world to basically, you know, Meta would basically give them a feed of stuff that is coming in that maybe should be looked at. And the first stuff that they went after, which I think they've been the most successful at, is the sort of classic fake news that I was writing about at the time, which is stuff that is 100% false, that was created to deceive. And often at that time, you know, the goal was financial, earn money because people clicked on the link and you had ads on the site. And so, you know, that was stuff that Facebook and other platforms have always felt, you know, really unencumbered about attacking, because it's like, no, this is totally false and it's deception and they're abusing our platform and our users in order to earn money. Let's kill that as quickly as we can. And so Facebook and Google went after the sort of the search traffic and the ad money side, kicking them out. And Facebook really demoted the heck out of a lot of those pages and links and those kinds of things. And so today, on a lot of these platforms, if you are consistently publishing 100% false stuff, like to earn money or what have you, you're probably not going to do very well. So I think they've been kind of successful in that. Whereas you mentioned, it's become much more fraught, and where they're trying to basically, you know, avoid as much attention as possible is when stuff is coming directly from political elites, political parties, people in the political infrastructure. You know, they don't want to be checking political candidates. They would much rather be dealing with, you know, silly false claims about Taylor Swift or what have you. And so I think that's where the difference comes in. They're good at the purely financially motivated 100% false actors. They are not great at and have a desire to really not want to deal too much with politically connected elites and institutions that are often sources of false and misleading info. And I think also, you know, they've been very slow on crypto scams and other things like that, which are just all over these platforms, and they know that it's happening. And I think it's really kind of shocking and disappointing that all these years that they have been investing in integrity efforts, they're still doing a really poor job keeping very obvious scams that lose people, in some cases, their life savings off their platforms. I think that is also a really disappointing area.
Sure. And I know another kind of attempted solution has been the idea of like community notes, where you're asking your users to fact check each other. Is that helpful, or is that just like a drop in the bucket?
You know, it's funny because, I mean, this just shows how old I am, because I think it was, I don't even know the year, but it was like pre-2010, I think, or around 2010, that I actually worked on a sort of crowdsourcing journalism experiment. And we had a team that were supposed to be, you know, crowdsourcing, fact-checking of the reporting that was being done. And so I think this idea of collaborative and crowdsourced verification, it's been around for a while. I personally have been talking about it since probably like 2004, 2005. And so I actually still think that if you run it the right way and you put in the right controls and you have the right incentives, those kinds of things can be really helpful. I mean, one of the pieces of advice that I give journalists when I'm talking to them about verification and digital investigations is, you know, when you're investigating a video, I actually tell them to read the comments. Read the comments on YouTube, because there might actually be people there who say, oh, wait a minute, I've seen this video before and I live in that neighborhood and this video is from here. It's not from where this person is claiming it's from. And I see that happen all the time where people have done good work. I mean, if you've ever seen like an active subreddit really dig in on something where people have expertise, like they can do great stuff. So I think as a principle, there's promise for it. When you look at kind of the biggest implementation of it, which is Twitter, I think that Elon Musk has talked a big game about it, as this could be, you know, the truth engine, the really big thing that helps. But I just don't think they've put enough resources into it to help get lots of people involved, to incentivize them to participate, and then to also have a fair process of what labels get applied and what don't. So I think it's been, unfortunately, it hasn't met its potential. And it seems almost like it's become something towards a fig leaf of saying, well, we have this. So that's where our, you know, our commitment is. But I think having it is not enough. You really need to grow and build it, like with any kind of community effort.
Yeah, fair enough. So one thing I think about a lot is the fire hose of falsehoods kind of idea, right? So this is an idea that came from the Rand Corporation, that basically you make people give up on trying to tell if information's true because you make them think, well, everything's just false now. Do you think that's a realistic fear? Do you think that people are giving up on news entirely?
I think it is a realistic dynamic. In fact, I think in some ways that's more likely to happen than to have somebody in a relatively short period of time radically change their point of view or convince them of a huge false narrative. I think it's more likely that they just get exhausted and they see conflicting information and they want to pull back. And I, you know, there has been research also on what's called news avoidance, of people who are just like, I do not want to be consuming a lot of news. I find it exhausting. I find it stressful. I have family members who, you know, absolutely are in a way making a concerted effort to not be reading and seeing a lot of news. And so I think the idea that if you give people an onslaught of, you know, information that is conflicting, that is false, that contradicts each other, I think that there's a certain cognitive overload that can happen for some people where they sort of throw up their hands and say, like, I'm just not sure what to believe and I don't trust any of y'all. And I've, you know, interacted and spoken to people who are sort of at that point. Particularly around politics, you know, they think, well, everybody's corrupt, you know, what does it matter? And so I do feel like that model and that idea has resonance, but the caution that we always have to put on that is, you know, these kinds of media effects, they're not instant. And sometimes I feel like people sort of talk about them as if, well, you know, if you read 5 false articles about this one claim, that person, they just might completely change their mind. And I think that that is not as likely as people may think. But what is more likely, I think, is this element of exhaustion and feeling overwhelmed and wanting to pull back and also wanting to sort of think like, you know, I'm just not sure which of these two ideas, you know, I should grab onto. And that's why I think, you know, the more we can do to help people feel a little more equipped and confident in their ability to kind of navigate things, not so overconfident that they never think they're going to be tricked, because that's not where you want to be, and not so overconfident that they think they've decided everything and know exactly how things are, but they could sit there and say like, okay, I've got two conflicting things. Let me look at these two claims and let me look at these two sources and let me try to figure out how they might differ. And then that becomes very empowering, where I think it's a good defense against that sort of fire hose of falsehood.
Yeah, but I feel like that's kind of an arms race, though. I think about, you know, you can have one debate, right? Or you can have one rally or something like that. And someone can throw out 34 lies in an hour, and it takes like a day and a half for the media to fact check all of the things they say. So that becomes a little depressing.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at Trump, the fact is people have become kind of numb to the amount of falsehoods and sort of outrageous things that he says. And so I think he has moved the bar, or, you know, the Overton window, or however you want to put it. And then I think there's other politicians and other people who look at his approach, which is, you know, never apologize, never back down, never admit you're wrong. And I think politicians in the past who might be chastened by things, who might feel the need to apologize, they're just like, no, let's just keep steamrolling. Let's just keep going. And so I think that model, you know, is we're seeing it play out in real time and in real life. And, you know, he's probably the best example of somebody who's just trying to overload the system to a certain extent.
Yeah. So it seems like then, you know, when they talked about the fire hose of falsehoods, they talked about the need to put raincoats on people, right, to help make them resistant to misinformation on their own. So if the audience is listening today and they could do two things to help improve the quality of the information they would get, what would you recommend?
I do think the first thing, which is kind of easy, and hopefully they're getting a little bit by, you know, consuming this, not only this episode, but this podcast in general, is just kind of an awareness that in this environment, it's not as easy or as wise to just sort of lean back and let it wash over you like you might have, you know, when it was just TV and radio and newspapers. You know, there's lots of great stuff out there, but you actually have to put a little more effort into it. And so being aware that it's an easily manipulated information environment, that well-meaning people might share things with you that are not true or are misleading and they don't know it. Being aware of that and just sort of holding that in your mind and being willing to just take a moment and not rush to judgment, that to me is sort of like the step one piece of it. Just awareness, a little bit of patience, a little bit of caution. Doesn't mean you question everybody who's around you, you know, all the time, but just sort of holding that as you're scrolling and browsing of like, all right, this is here, that's there. So that's kind of the first piece of it. And then the second thing I would say is just think about like the claim of what's in front of you. And maybe it's because I've, you know, been in this sort of debunking and fact-checking and verifying role for so long, but like when I'm reading an article or I'm looking at a meme or a video, I try to set aside what the emotional stuff is and what have you. But if there's actually making a claim, what is the information here that is trying to be conveyed? Are they making a claim about a person? Are they making a general comment about society? But what evidence and claims and information are they using to marshal that? And if you're sort of sitting there and sort of leaning back a little bit and saying, all right, you know, here's information in front of me. What are the claims? What's trying to be communicated? Then all of a sudden, I feel like your brain actually shifts into a different mode of information consumption. It's not the passive kind of system one, I'm just going to go based on my experience and my feelings. You sort of lean back into the system two, where you become just a little bit more analytical. You're a little more patient. Your emotions don't get the better of you. And so for me, it's really almost just like a behavioral thing that people can practice. You don't need complicated tools or anything like that. It's just that behavior, which I think people will find is really helpful if they do it.
Huh, great. Well, I really appreciate your time for this week's episode, and thank you so much. Thanks for getting Unspun with me this week. Unspun is a production of me, Amanda Sturgill, and is a proud member of the MSW Media family of podcasts. Send me your thoughts and ideas about trickery in the news on Gmail at theunspunpodcast@gmail.com. I even write back. And find this episode's show notes and more information at theunspunpodcast.substack.com. Want to learn more and get smarter? Check out my book, Detecting Deception, Tools to Fight Fake News, which is available on Amazon or your favorite online bookseller. And until next time, stay sharp, everyone.
Hi, I'm Mojiela Wodeyal from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.